Welcome back. In my last lecture, I introduced us to the development of farming communities in the Nile Valley, in what's now Egypt. I was particularly emphasizing, as I did so, changes in ecological circumstances in the Nile Valley from about 12,000 years ago onward. And I want you to keep that in mind. I want you to be conscious as we're going over this next period, the pre-dynastic period, of continuing changes in the environmental circumstances of northeastern Africa. And I also want you to be conscious of my emphasis on those ecological determinants of cultural development, because that's important as well. The particular element that I want to note is that by about 5000 BC, the period of increased rainfall in northeastern Africa, and actually more generally over northern Africa, was coming to an end. That we were seeing at this time a decrease of rainfall over this vast area toward modern levels. Keep that in mind. I'm going to come back to it. I also noted the striking contrasts between cultural developments in the Nile Valley and in Mesopotamia, and particularly southern Mesopotamia, at or just before 4000 BC, at the time when we start to see the first agricultural settlements in the Fayum and on the Nile itself in Lower Egypt. At this point in Mesopotamia, agricultural communities, farming communities, had already been established for many thousands of years. There were long-distance trading networks extending well beyond Mesopotamia itself, toward Anatolia, into what's now the Arabian Peninsula, into southern Iran. Social ranking was well established throughout Mesopotamia, and Mesopotamian communities were really on the way to becoming truly urban communities. In the Nile Valley at the same time, farming communities were only beginning to appear, and settlements, as far as we can see, were generally small and relatively egalitarian. Yet true states would appear in both areas at about the same time, approximately 1,000 years later, about 3000 BC. What was that intervening millennium like in the Nile Valley? It was presumably fairly dynamic. In Egyptology, this period is usually designated the pre-dynastic. Its exact dating, though, unfortunately, is not well understood. We have far better control of chronology through the succession of cultures I talked about in Mesopotamia. Hassunan, Halathian, Sumerian, Ubaid, Uruk. Even though it extends considerably further back in time, our confidence about the dating of those periods of those cultures is actually greater than it is for the pre-dynastic in the Nile Valley. Egyptologists have traditionally depended upon texts to provide a chronological framework for their investigations. But as you can imagine, texts are not very much help before the invention of writing at, again, about 3000 BC. To this point, there are not a very large number of pre-dynastic radiocarbon dates, with radiocarbon dating being the by far the most prevalent dating technique used by archaeologists for the time periods that we're talking about in this set of lectures. To some degree, then, the pre-dynastic has been the poor relation of Egyptology, as I noted at the end of my last lecture. It was relatively ignored in favor of the more spectacular monuments and processes of the classical Egyptian dynastic period. But it was obviously a period of quite radical change for Nile Valley societies. And it was extraordinarily important from the point of view of this set of lectures, because this is where the pathway to statehood for classical Egypt was established. So what can we say about this period? All of the early settlements between about 6,000 and 4,000 BC in and around the Nile Valley seem to have been small-scale, low-density farming communities with relatively simple farming technologies. Note, almost no irrigation during this period. Now, there is an important contrast with Mesopotamia. What we see in the Nile Valley instead is dependence on what's called falling water agriculture, in which crops are planted in the fields just after the Nile floods have subsided. After the fields have been inundated, as they're draining, that is when you plant. It's a very, very effective, efficient agricultural method. It would not have been possible along the Tigris or Euphrates, because the floods were neither as predictable nor of the same magnitude and characteristics. But during this time period anyway, Egyptian populations did not feel it necessary to experiment with significant irrigation systems. We see in these Egyptian communities, in these Nile Valley communities, the same set of West Asian domesticates, both plant and animal domesticates, as in Mesopotamia. We also see a continuing use of wild plants and animals, both those of the Nile Valley and the Nile Delta itself, and those existing along the edge of the desert or the area that is today the desert. There's far greater use of these resources in the Nile Valley than during the same period in Mesopotamia, possibly because of the existence of lower population densities in the Nile Valley, and thus more possibility for hunting and gathering. Now, most explanations of the adoption of agriculture and increasing and social and political complexity in the Nile Valley have been heavily ecological, in keeping with the importance of the Nile in the area today. Researchers tend to see agriculture and the development of agriculture in this area as a response to the nature of the Nile floods in the early Holocene, which made the Nile Valley itself relatively unattractive for agriculture and the areas around it more attractive for human habitation. But then these first droughts of the mid-Holocene, starting between 5,000 and 6,000 BC, which portend a shift in Egyptian environments. The desert, the Sahara, is coming back. What I want as well to note here, though, is the contrast with the models that archaeologists use to explain the rise of states and civilizations in Mesopotamia, which stress population increase, trade, and the intensification of trade, irrigation, communal building projects, and centralization over long periods. So one of the things that we have to ask ourselves then is, do these different models actually reflect significant cultural differences in the two areas? Or are we in danger of overinterpreting things according to these different models? Egypt did have lower population densities, as far as we can see, during the pre-dynastic period, and thus there appears to be far less potential for competition for arable land. We also have relatively less information on trade in the Nile Valley, in part because not as much research has been done on the topic as has been done in Mesopotamia, where, of course, this is a real theme of research. Most trade in Egypt would certainly have taken place along the Nile. This will be a significant factor throughout Egyptian history, that we have this river that dominates all of habited Egypt. Virtually any population center is only a few miles away from the Nile, and the river provides an avenue for trade that allows relatively easy communication between different regions of Egypt. What we would have seen then along the Nile, I used this term in an earlier lecture, I talked about linear down-the-line trading systems, where goods are passed via middlemen from one community to the next. Goods would have been sequentially passed down from one community to the next. Now note, it's more or less impossible, using that sort of down-the-line trading system, to bypass intervening groups. You have to sort of sail past them on the river, which probably wouldn't have been that easy. They might have resisted that. The presence of the river would make sophisticated long-distance trading networks, like those of Uruk, Mesopotamia, and remember that trading network, both less feasible because of the dominance of down-the-line trade, and less necessary because, of course, there was not the need for staple products in certain areas along the Nile in the same way that there was in Mesopotamia. By the late 5th and 4th millennia BC, then, these early farming communities and the small territories they controlled were strung out along the Nile in both Upper and Lower Egypt, almost like beads on a string. There were important cultural differences between Upper and Lower Egypt during this period. These included differences, for example, in the types of ceramics and stone tools being made in these different regions. The architecture of these different regions was somewhat different. And as we're going to see, we actually even see some differences in social and political centralization at various times. These differences between Upper and Lower Egypt were to a great extent erased after the unification of Egypt at approximately 3000 BC. Through the pre-dynastic period, between, say, about 4000 and 3000 BC, we see steadily increasing population densities and larger settlements along the Nile. In Lower Egypt, Madi, on the outskirts of modern Cairo, where the Nile opens out onto the Nile Delta, is dated to about 3650 BC and was a large farming settlement, albeit one with only very simple architecture of wood and other more organic material. It wasn't a situation where in the Nile Valley at this point we were seeing the structures in mud brick that one was seeing in Uruk, Mesopotamia at the same time. There's a good deal of evidence for trade beyond the Nile Valley at this site, at least as far away as Sinai and Palestine, and possibly to Uruk, Mesopotamia. The housing patterns, actually, are reminiscent of those of contemporary architecture in Palestine. So here we see some evidence, at least, of significant degrees of contact between this part of the Nile Valley, near the Nile Delta, and regions beyond the Nile Valley. Copper was smelted on the site. Ingots of copper found, as well as flint blades that were probably used in export. The copper itself probably originated in the Sinai. And what we see through the pre-dynastic period is that copper is becoming a prestige material. Artifacts made of copper are significantly valuable to the developing elites that we see in the later pre-dynastic. Related sites, still near the Nile Delta, in fact, in the northern Nile Delta, in the case of the site of Buto, were occupied until the end of the pre-dynastic period. While there are certainly trade items and artistic influences from Mesopotamia at places like Buto, And while there are no evidences for equivalent influences from Egypt toward Mesopotamia, there's still no reason to think that state formation in Egypt did not take place along entirely indigenous lines. In Upper Egypt, these farming communities belong to a succession of increasingly complex cultures, known sequentially as the Bedarian culture between perhaps 4500 and 3900 BC, the Amratian culture between about 3900 and 3500 BC, and the Gertzian culture between perhaps 3400 and 3200 BC. The dates for particularly the Bedarian and the Amratian are approximate. There's also many sorts of similarities between these different pre-dynastic traditions in Upper Egypt, and so we should not think of them as being sharply differentiated. They form a sort of cultural continuum. They're distinguished by increasingly sophisticated production of stone tools, a development of different ceramic styles, and progressively larger settlements through time, so that the site of Nekin, or to use the Greek term, Hierakonpolis, the largest Gertzian center, probably housed between 8,000 and 10,000 people at 3400 BC, and this was Egypt's first real town. So we could probably think of this. We can see some of the processes equivalent to those in the Ubaid or early Uruk periods in Mesopotamia, in social systems and political systems, beginning to be evident in the Nile Valley. There was significant cultural continuity between these successive cultural traditions, as I noted. Pre-dynastic Nekin, or Hierakonpolis, included at least one large structure, possibly a temple or a palace of some sort, and the town was at least partially walled. One of the things we have to note here is the different order of events from Mesopotamia. In Mesopotamia, temples appear before there's any real need for fortification, as far as we can see, while in the Nile Valley they appear at the same time. It's possible that this need for fortification was associated with those environmental and political changes that I talked about in the late pre-dynastic period and in this part of northeastern Africa more generally. We have to remember, this is extremely important, that by 3500 BC, drying climates in northeastern Africa were making the areas east and west of the Nile less and less tenable for human habitation. It was getting harder and harder for those populations. These would have not, for the most part, been farming populations. They would have been pastoralists, cattle pastoralists, people herding sheep and goats, perhaps, very likely actually, hunter and gatherer populations as well. It was becoming less and less possible by 3500 BC for those people to survive in the areas beyond the Nile Valley. And this was simply happening because the Sahara was coming back. These areas that are now desert were turning into the Western Desert and the Eastern Desert. And their populations were in a great deal of trouble at this time. And these areas would, of course, ultimately become extreme desert. The implications of this were the populations that had occupied these regions since the early Holocene were beginning to be forced to move into those limited areas where water was still available. This was, first, the oases to the west of the Nile. Areas like Nabta Playa, the Fayum. But increasingly, they were being driven toward the Nile Valley. You can imagine the desperation of people afflicted by successive years of drought. Their land is becoming less and less possible to live in. What's to be done? You have to go to where there's water. There's certainly early dynastic evidence after approximately 3000 BC for Egyptian conflict with those people who are known to the Egyptians as the Libyans, the inhabitants of the lands west of the Nile. And this was almost certainly true of the late pre-dynastic period as well, just before 3000 BC. So we can understand under these circumstances why it is that Hierakonpolis, Nekhen, may have needed that wall. And if so, this could also have helped consolidate and legitimate the power of chiefs in communities along the Nile, and especially those paramount chiefs capable of commanding military forces and defeating foreign raiders. Thus, pre-dynastic Upper Egypt, and this is, remember, this is the area I'm talking about now, particularly Upper Egypt, seems to have been a place of increasing political competition between a small number of successful and increasingly large and expansionistic chiefdoms arrayed along the Nile. These included Nekhen, with its capital at the town of the same name, also known, as I said, as Hierakonpolis, Naqada, and the site of Abydos. At least, these centers were probably the winners in a competition for power and control over resources that had played out through the pre-dynastic. By the end of the pre-dynastic period, we can probably think of these different centers in Upper Egypt as small states, each with a ruler, some sort of effective military force, and at least nascent, a forming bureaucracy. There is certainly abundant evidence for social differentiation and political hierarchy in late pre-dynastic Upper Egyptian communities, primarily, again, as is the case in many of these areas, from the cemeteries that are found associated with habitation sites. These cemeteries include, in some cases, burials of individuals who were probably paramount chiefs or even rulers of small states, judging by the grave goods that accompanied them in death. When I spoke about Mesopotamia, I talked about the importance of cemeteries as a source of archaeological interpretation for social hierarchy and political hierarchy. This is certainly the case, for example, when we look at the tomb of an individual at Abydos in Upper Egypt, who ruled at about 3200 BC and who was interred with a whole variety of very valuable grave goods and 700 jars of wine. This is tomb UJ at Abydos. Presumably, somebody really wanted to enjoy the afterlife. On a more sobering note, there's even evidence of human sacrifice associated with the death of rulers at Naqada, as there would be in the first dynasty times in Egypt as well, after about 3000 BC. Again, in Mesopotamia, I spoke about that. I talked about the powerful message
of the tomb here,
that human sacrifice sends, that the individual who has died is so different, so much not a part of normal human life and normal
social relations.
As you'll see in the foreground, in that middle room in the foreground,
he can command.
It's almost always a he, not in every case, but almost always a he, can command the death of his followers, that they will follow him into the grave. Interestingly enough, there's not really equivalent evidence of social differences in lower Egyptian cemeteries of this same time period, of the late pre-dynastic time period, just before 3000 BC. although some degree of hierarchy almost certainly existed there. But in fact, this is one of the major contrasts between Upper and Lower Egypt at the time. I spoke about differences in material culture and ceramics and stone tools and so on, but this difference in hierarchies, in the expression of hierarchies and cemeteries between Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt is quite significant. This may be because Lower Egyptian sites are not as much excavated from the late pre-dynastic period as are those in Upper Egypt, but it may also involve a greater dispersal of resources through particularly the Nile Delta than was the case further up the river. It's also important to realize here that urban centers were not as significant in early Egyptian cultural and political developments as they were in contemporary Mesopotamia. Nekhen, Hierakonpolis, seems to have been the largest population center in Egypt during the pre-dynastic, and it was perhaps half the size of Uruk at the same time. And Uruk was itself one of a dozen or so such towns in Mesopotamia. This pattern would continue into the dynastic period in Egypt as well. This is probably at least in part due to the lower original population densities in the Nile Valley as opposed to southern Mesopotamia, which can in turn be ascribed at least in part to the later development of farming in Egypt. The course of cultural development in the Nile Valley during the pre-dynastic period is perhaps not as well understood as in Mesopotamia, but it would lead to very dramatic consequences at the beginning of the third millennium BC. Consequences that would result in the appearance of something quite different in the Egyptian case. A state? Yes. We see the appearance of an Egyptian state at the same time as we see the appearance of the state in Mesopotamia, but there's a great difference. In the Nile Valley, what appears at about 3000 BC is a territorial state, far larger and very differently organized than any of the city-states that existed along the Tigris and Euphrates at the same time. So, for my next lecture, I'll talk about this period of tremendous political and cultural and social change in the Nile Valley in Egypt at about 3000 BC, which will result then in the appearance of an Egyptian territorial state. Thank you.